Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Fresh start.
Democracy has prevailed.
An historic oath.
I, Kamala Davie Harris, solemnly swear.
Joe Biden opens his presidency with a plea for unity.
My whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause.
Promising action on the pandemic.
Let me be very clear. Things are going to continue to get worse before they get better.
And the economy.
We have to act now.
America's 46th president confronts multiple crises as the Senate prepares to try a former president for the first time.
Senators will have to decide if they believe Donald John Trump incited the insurrection.
We covered all this morning with Senators Amy Klobuchar and Rand Paul, America's next Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, and our Powerhouse Roundtable.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, Chief Anchor George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. The end came slowly, then suddenly. After a transition that redefined tumultuous, Inauguration Day opened with these final words from President Trump. Have a good life. See you soon. Followed by this first declaration from President Biden. Democracy has prevailed. The shift in style and substance was stark. Now comes the challenge of confronting the cascading crises outlined by President Biden in his inaugural address and confronting the behavior of President Trump that sparked an insurrection. Our new poll with Ipsos shows a solid majority of Americans approve of Biden's pandemic plans and believe he can make progress on unifying the country. But the divisions in Congress already demonstrating how tough it will be for President Biden to advance his agenda. Congressional correspondent Rachel Scott starts us off. Good morning, Rachel.
George, good morning. And it is the impeachment trial of the former president, Donald Trump, that will be casting a shadow over President Biden's administration. Tomorrow, we will see that article of impeachment be walked over to the Senate. And then on Tuesday, senators will be sworn in as jurors. But that impeachment trial will not be starting for two more weeks. We're looking at the week of February 8th. And this is a delay that both sides agreed to. Democrats were worried about this balancing act of having the Senate juggle that impeachment trial, confirmation hearings, and trying to consider Biden's agenda. And Republicans wanted to give Trump more time to prepare. He's really struggled to put together a defense team. So this gives both sides the wiggle room that they were looking for. But this morning, it is still unclear how long the trial will last, who will preside over it, and whether or not witnesses will be allowed. Of course, this is an unusual situation where the lawmakers, the jurors in this trial, were all witnesses to what happened here on January 6th. At least 17 Republicans in the Senate would need to join every single Democrat in order to convict the president. In the House, we saw 10 Republicans vote to impeach the president. But now nearly every single one of those Republicans is facing significant backlash. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the number three House Republican, she voted to impeach. She had some of the harshest words for Trump. She's now fending off attacks from her own party. She already has a primary challenger now. Some Republicans calling for her to be removed from leadership. That vote to impeach, George, has turned into a fight for her political life.
Boy, it sure has. Okay, Rachel, thanks very much. Let's bring in our chief Washington correspondent, John Carl, for more on this. We're seeing the backlash that Liz Cheney is facing in the House that could complicate this push for conviction by the Senate Democrats.
The bottom line, George, right now, Donald Trump is not going to get convicted in the Senate unless there are major new revelations. Mitch McConnell hasn't ruled out voting for conviction, but nobody who I have talked to close to McConnell thinks there's any chance that he would actually vote to convict. That said, George, during this trial, unlike the last impeachment trial, you're not going to see significant numbers of Republicans coming out to actually defend Donald Trump. They will focus on the process and the constitutionality. They will argue that it is neither wise nor is it constitutional to convict somebody in an impeachment trial, a president who has already left office, that although Donald Trump may have committed what amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors, impeachment is meant to remove a president from office, pure and simple, is what the Republicans will argue. And Donald Trump, of course, is already gone.
President Biden has tried to stay out of this impeachment fight. He wants to advance his agenda at the same time, which means that both sides don't mind this couple-of-week delay.
No, and certainly not Biden. Look, George, if you were to take a look at all of the priorities that Biden has for the beginning of his administration, impeachment would rank somewhere below 100. The Biden White House simply does not care about this. Their biggest concern is that impeachment could block Biden's agenda in Congress. So, no, absolutely no complaints about the delay from either side, especially no complaints from Biden.
And it appears that the Republican Party is coalescing around objections to the size of President Biden's COVID relief plan.
$1.9 trillion. They've made it clear, really every Republican, including Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, the ones you would expect to work with the president on this, have made it clear that's too much. That said, I think there is an emerging possibility of a compromise. But of course, George, the big question is whether or not the two sides can come to an agreement about how to actually organize the Senate. There's a big dispute over whether or not to rule out the filibuster. That's what McConnell is insisting on. And until that's resolved, they won't be able to do any of this.
Okay, John Carl, thanks very much. Let's bring in two senators who will serve as jurors for Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. Democrat Amy Klobuchar, Republican Rand Paul. Senator Paul, let me begin with a threshold question for you. This election was not stolen. Do you accept that fact?
Well, what I would say is that the debate over whether or not there was fraud should occur. We never had any presentation in court where we actually looked at the evidence. Most of the cases were thrown out for lack of standing, which is a procedural way of not actually hearing the question. There were several states in which the law was changed by the Secretary of State and not the state legislature. To me, those are clearly unconstitutional. And I think there's still a chance that those actually do finally work their way up to the Supreme Court. Courts traditionally and historically don't like to hear election questions. But yes, were there people who voted twice? Were there dead people who voted? Were there illegal aliens who voted? Yes, and we should get to the bottom of it. I'll give you an example. In my state, when we had a Democrat Secretary of State, she refused, even under federal order, to purge the rolls of illegal voters. We got a Republican Secretary of State, and he purged the rolls.
Senator Paul,
I have to stop you there.
No election is perfect, but there were 86 challenges filed by President Trump and his allies in court. All were dismissed. Every state certified the results after
investigations, counts, and recounts.
The Department of Justice, led by William Barr, said there's no widespread evidence of fraud. Can't you just say the words, this election was not stolen?
What I would suggest is that if we want greater confidence in our elections, and 75% of Republicans agree with me, is that we do need to look at election integrity, and we do need to see if we can restore confidence in the elections.
Well, 75% of Republicans agree with you because they were fed a big lie by President Trump and his supporters who say the election was stolen. Why can't you say
where you make a mistake is that people coming from the liberal side like you, you immediately say everything's a lie instead of saying there are two sides to everything. Historically, what would happen is if I said that I thought there was fraud, you would interview someone else who said there wasn't. But now you insert yourself in the middle and say the absolute fact is that everything I'm saying is a lie.
Well, because, Senator, I said what the president said was a lie because he said, hold on a second, he said the election was stolen. This election was not stolen. The results were certified in every single state after counts and recounts.
You're saying that absolutely it was, you're saying there was no fraud and it's all been investigated. That's just not true.
It's not what I said, sir. I said the Department of Justice found no evidence.
Let
me finish my point.
You
said something that was not true.
You say we're all liars. You're just simply saying we're all liars. And
I said it was a lie that the election was stolen.
Premise that you're right and we're wrong. Well, let's talk about the specifics of it. In Wisconsin, tens of thousands of absentee votes had only the name on them and no address. Historically, those were thrown out. This time, they weren't. They made special accommodations because they said, oh, it's a pandemic, and people forgot what their address was. So they changed the law after the fact. That is wrong. That's unconstitutional. And I plan on spending the next 2 years going around state to state and fixing these problems. And I won't be cowed by liberals in the media who say, there's no evidence here, and you're a liar if you talk about election fraud. No, let's have an open debate. It's a free country.
There's no widespread evidence of election fraud that overturned the results. That was stated as well by the Department of Justice, led by President Trump's Attorney General. In Wisconsin, there were counts and recounts.
Actually, it was never studied. Even that's not true.
William Barr said that directly.
But there was, yes, he said that. Yes, that was a pronouncement. There has been no examination, thorough examination of all the states to see what problems we had and see if they could fix them. Now, let me say, to be clear, I voted to certify the state electors because I think it would be wrong for Congress to overturn that. But at the same time, I'm not willing just to sit here and say, oh, everybody on the Republican side is a liar and there is no fraud. No, there were lots of problems and there were secretaries of state who illegally changed the law and that needs to be fixed. And I'm going to work hard to fix it. And I won't be cowed by people saying, oh, you're a liar. That's the problem with the media today is they say all Republicans are liars and everything we say is a lie. There are two sides to every story. Interview somebody on the other side, but don't insert yourself into the story to say we're all liars because we think there's some fraud in the election.
There are not two sides to the story. This has been looked at in every single state. The election
There are two sides to every story. George, you're forgetting who you are. You're forgetting who you are as a journalist. If you think there's only one side, you're inserting yourself into the story to say, I'm a liar because I want to look at election fraud and I want to look at secretaries of state who illegally changed the voter laws without the permission of their state legislatures. That is incontrovertible. It happened. And you can't just sweep that under the rug and say, oh, nothing to see here. And everybody's a liar and you're a fool if you bring this up. You're inserting yourself into the story. A journalist would hear both sides, and there are two sides to this story.
I'm standing by facts. There are not two sides to facts. I did not say that this was a perfect election. I said it was. The results were certified. I said it was not stolen.
You're saying people are liars. You're saying people are liars if they want to investigate what happened in the election.
That's not what I said.
The fact that tens of thousands of absentee ballots did not have addresses on them and normally were disqualified, but this time they were counted. Should we examine that? I don't know whether it affected the election or not, but I have an open mind. And if we actually examine this and we find out it didn't, that's fine, but it still should be fixed.
There can be more investigations. The investigations that have taken place have shown there is not enough fraud to change the results of this election. That has been certified by every state. It was stated by the Justice Department and the Attorney General.
And I accepted the state certifications, but it doesn't mean that I think that there wasn't fraud and that there weren't problems that have to be investigated, and it doesn't mean that the law wasn't broken. I believe in Pennsylvania they broke the law, and I believe if that ever would get a real hearing in the Supreme Court, it was denied for standing. It wasn't actually taken up. If it were taken up, I do believe that the Supreme Court would overrule and say that they did break the law illegally.
I asked you a very simple question. Was the election stolen or not?
I think there was a great deal of evidence of fraud and changing of the election laws illegally, and I think a thorough investigation is warranted.
Senator Paul, thanks for your time this morning. Let me bring in Senator Klobuchar now. Let me talk, first of all, Senator Klobuchar, about this impeachment proposal now in the Senate. The trial is going to start on February 9th. I was hoping to get to this with Senator Paul. We ran out of time there, but the GOP is signaling they're going to be making a process argument, that it's not constitutional to try a former president, that it won't be legitimate if Chief Justice Roberts does not preside. Your response?
It is constitutional. We have precedent from way back when a Secretary of War was tried after he had left office. And obviously there's a remedy that would help in the future, which would ban former President Trump from running again. But as I listened to Rand Paul, George, I just kept thinking, man, this is why Joe Biden won. The American people right now are struggling. They need pandemic relief. They are literally trying to balance their toddlers on their knees and their laptops on their desk and teaching their first graders how to use a mute button just to go to school. They need help. And I thoroughly believe that we can handle this impeachment trial and, just as the American people are doing, juggle what we need to get done. Get the Homeland Security Secretary through. We just had an insurrection at the Capitol. Get people confirmed for Joe Biden's cabinet. And, yes, get people the help that they need. That's what this next month is going to be about.
You just heard John Carl say he doesn't believe there are the votes there to convict President Trump right now. And we saw President Trump after the first trial, going to show those pictures right here, when the votes weren't there to convict, he waved the acquitted headline, said this was vindication for him. You concerned that could happen again?
My colleagues have not yet committed about what they're going to do. And the news we just got out of the New York Times yesterday that the president was actually actively trying to take out his own attorney general and put in an unknown bureaucrat conspiring with him, I think we're going to get more and more evidence over the next few weeks, as if it's not enough that he sent an angry mob down the mall to invade the Capitol, didn't try to stop it, and a police officer was killed. I don't really know what else you need to know. The facts were there. We saw it right there on the platform during the inauguration, as you could still see the spray paint at the bottom of many of the columns.
But if the votes aren't there to convict, would you pursue instead either a censure or some kind of a resolution under the 14th Amendment to prevent President Trump from running for office again?
We're focused on impeachment, but there are many options. Things can get looked at. But I think the thing that your viewers need to know right now, George, is that we must do many things at once. There is so much problems out there for the American people. They want those vaccines. And I'm so glad that Joe Biden invoked the Defense Production Act so we can get them produced. We can get the distribution centers set up. We can make sure that schools can open again. That's what he's focused on. That's what we're focused on. And we can do this impeachment trial at the same time. We could run it in the afternoons, confirm the nominees in the morning, and pass legislation at night.
As you know, you don't have an agreement with the Republicans.
About the politics of how this would work. Well,
as you know, you don't have an agreement yet to get
that negotiated.
And that's what I want to ask you about.
All right.
Whether you can get the organizing resolution through, and also with Republicans now saying that the president's plan is far too big, do you still hold out hope for a bipartisan agreement, or are Democrats going to have to go it alone through reconciliation?
We had a fine agreement back in 2001. I wasn't there, but George Bush was president, and we worked it out with even numbers on the committees. But Democrats can be in charge this time because of the fact that we have the deciding vote. Those are things that can be worked out easily. Mitch McConnell knows it. Secondly, when it comes to how we're going to get things done, we're in charge, and with even votes, we should be able to get legislation to the floor, including the pandemic relief package. As for the amount that Joe Biden has proposed, that's exactly the numbers we were talking about last summer. And at some point, the administration was talking those numbers. And why do we need it? Because we don't even have areas of our country are getting very small numbers of the vaccine. We've got people with pre-existing conditions that have been literally isolated for nearly a year waiting for help with this vaccine. Of course, we need the funding to get that vaccine distribution out there. We got to stop messing around and get our economy going again. That's what Joe Biden's proposal is about.
Senator Klobuchar, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, George.
President Biden's pick for Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, is up next, plus our Powerhouse Roundtable. Stay with us.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Our plan starts with mounting an aggressive, safe, and effective vaccination campaign to meet our goal of administering 100 million shots in our first 100 days in office.
Is that high enough? Should you set the bar higher? That's basically where the U.S. is right now. When I announced it, you all said it's not possible. Come on, give me a break, man.
Come on, you guys.
It's a good start.
Joe Biden bristled a bit when asked if his vaccine plan is ambitious enough, but there are big questions going forward as the COVID death toll threatens to climb past 600,000 in the coming months. Here to answer some of them, the president's nominee for Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, thank you for joining us this morning. Let's talk about that goal for 100 million vaccines in 100 days. As you know, it's many experts have weighed in saying the plan is not ambitious enough. We need to do better. Can we do better? Will we do better?
Well, thanks, George. It's great to be with you today. As President Biden has said, he set a goal of 100 million shots in his first 100 days in office. That's a floor. It's not a ceiling. It's also a goal that reflects the realities of what we face, what could go right, but also what could go wrong. And I think President Biden fully understands there's a larger goal here, as we all do, which is that we've got to vaccinate as many Americans as possible. And that's going to take a lot of work, work dispelling misinformation, working on the supply, increasing distribution channels. And that's some of what the vaccine plan that he announced over the last week is intended to achieve.
Are there ways to increase the supply, number one? And number two, on the distribution, it appears, at least in these first vaccines that have gone out, they've been going largely to wealthier areas of the country, largely to whiter areas of the country. Is there a way to get more equitable distribution and increase the supply?
Well, it's the right question, George, because success has to be gauged not just by the number of vaccines we deliver, but also by how fairly we deliver those vaccines, how equitably we deliver them. We already know from the COVID crisis over the past year that there are certain communities that have been hard hit by this virus, that rural communities have had a harder time getting access to resources, the communities of color have experienced more cases and deaths, that seniors have struggled, especially those in long-term facilities. And what we've got to do here is not just, again, increase supply, which we can do using the Defense Production Act, making specific syringes that can extract more vaccine from the Pfizer bottles, but we've also got to set up the kind of distribution channels like mobile units, like strategically placed community vaccination centers that can reach people who traditionally are hard to reach and don't have access to healthcare. And lastly, George, we've got to track our progress. We've got to make sure that we have data on where the vaccine is being administered so that we can ensure that it, in fact, is being distributed equitably.
How about the next vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Is that close to approval?
Well, we're hopeful that we'll get good news on that front, George, because the truth is the more vaccine that we have in terms of options, in terms of supply, the more quickly we'll be able to vaccinate the country. But what's important is that we focus and plan for what we have right now. And, you know, the goal of achieving 100 million shots in 100 days is one that is achievable with the supply that we have and that we're anticipating from Pfizer and from Moderna. And that's what we've got to focus on. So we hope for the best, but we've got a plan for the situation we have now.
I want to ask you about this variant of the COVID that is now in the United Kingdom. At least 20 states say it's here now as well. And the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said this week there is evidence that it is more deadly than other strains. I know that last month you said we didn't have enough evidence to say that it's more deadly. Has that changed?
Well, I'm glad you're bringing this up, George, because the variants are very concerning, but they are not surprising. Because this is what viruses do. They mutate, they change, and we should expect that. But here's what we know. We know that the variant, not just the UK variant, but likely the South Africa variant, the Brazilian variant P1, are likely to be more transmissible. And while there's some early data that was reported on early this week that the UK variant may in fact be more deadly, we still need more data to clearly understand the answer to that question. But here's a larger lesson, George, from the variants. They are really a shot across the bow. The virus is basically telling us that it's going to continue to change, and we've got to be ready for it. And what does that mean? Well, it means we've got to, number one, do much better genomic surveillance so we can identify variants when they arise. It means we've got to double down on public health measures like masking and avoiding indoor gatherings. It also means investing more in something we haven't talked about very much recently, which is in treatment strategies, which have received a lot less attention than vaccines, but are really important. And above all, this means we've got to invest a lot more in testing and in contact tracing, because these also are going to be essential. So the bottom line is we're in a race against these variants. The virus is going to change, and it's up to us to adapt and to make sure that we're staying ahead.
Are you confident that we can meet President Biden's other goal to get most elementary schools open in the first 100 days?
Well, that's a very important goal. You know, I'll tell you, as a parent who has two young children, one of whom is trying to do virtual learning because his school is not open, and we're all struggling with that. I know how critical it is for schools to get open, for parents, for the economy, for all of us. It's going to take a lot of work, though, and it's on several fronts we've got to focus. Number one, getting clear guidance to schools on what they need to do to reopen. Number two, we've got to make sure schools have the resources to be able to reopen and take these measures, and a lot of them don't have the resources. I mean, keep in mind, George, that each and every day, we have teachers across the country who are reaching into their pocket to find a few dollars to pay for supplies for their kids. They don't have money to pay for the safety provisions that are needed on their own. We've got to get them those resources. If we get them the resources and the guidance, I do think that we can get on a path to reopening schools more safely. But it's also going to take us getting the background number of cases down in our communities. And that's where we all come in. Achieving these goals, turning COVID around, is a goal that we have to undertake together as one nation. And if we do that, then I'm confident we can turn this pandemic around.
And finally, can we get to herd immunity before the next school year begins in September?
Well, I think that's an ambitious goal. I think we can see improvement. I think we can see reductions in cases and hospitalizations and deaths. I think we can see many more people immunized. But I think what's important here, rather than focusing on a specific number in terms of percentage of the population for herd immunity, is to recognize that the more people we vaccinate, the better we will do. The fewer outbreaks we will see, the sooner we can get back to our way of life. And that's what we've got to focus on right now. That means each and every one of us has to think about how we can dispel misinformation, make sure our family and friends have the right information. It means as soon as possible is when the categories are open to us that we make an appointment and go get vaccinated ourselves. If we do these things, and if we continue to work on taking the safety precautions like masking and avoiding indoor gatherings with people outside your household, then I think we can be on a path to not only turning the pandemic around, but most importantly, getting our schools open, our workplaces back up and running, and regaining our way of life.
Dr. Murthy, thanks for your time this morning.
This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge. And unity is the path forward. And we must meet this moment as the United States of America. If we do that, I guarantee you we will not fail.
It is Joe Biden's inaugural week, and as we noted up top, our new poll with Ipsos shows most Americans are confident that Biden can make progress on unifying the country. 538's Nate Silver took a look at how long that might last.
President Biden is starting out with positive marks as Americans look to turn the page after a challenging year. According to a recent ABC News Washington Post poll, 67% of voters approved of his presidential transition as compared to 40% for President Trump 4 years ago. Odds are, though, that this will fade as it has for previous presidents. Barack Obama's approval rating peaked at 65% when he first entered office, but fell to under 50% within his first year. And Bill Clinton's numbers fell from 60% to 37% just 5 months into his term. At the same time, Biden could have more of a wind at his back than you might think. There are a couple of key reasons for that, so let's break them down. First, the economy is expected to grow by 4.3% this year as it recovers from the COVID pandemic, which, if it happens, would make for the strongest year since 1999. One more thing that could help Biden, ironically, is that Democrats have such narrow majorities in Congress that they're unlikely to have the votes for anything terribly unpopular like Obamacare was in 2009. And the stimulus packages that Congress might consider poll pretty well. Finally, although there aren't that many swing voters left these days, Biden has always done well with independents. He carried them by 13 points on Election Day. And his more, how to put it, traditional approach to governance is likely to form an especially favorable contrast to Trump after the violent end to his term. So if the question is, do you buy that Biden can unite the country? I mean, it's a pretty high threshold to clear, and I think the obvious answer is no. But I do think he has above average chances of having a successful first year or two in office if he can get the COVID pandemic under control.
It is my greatest honor and privilege to have been your president. I will be watching, I will be listening, and I will tell you that the future of this country has never been better. I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success. They have the foundation to do something really spectacular. So have a good life. We will see you soon.
President Trump's final words as president right there on Wednesday, Inauguration Day. Big week in politics. Let's talk about it on our roundtable, joined by Chris Christie, Rahm Emanuel, Margaret Hoover, the host of Firing Line on PBS, also a CNN contributor, and our political analyst, Matthew Dowd. And Chris, let me begin with you. I mean, let's start out with that back and forth I had with Rand Paul. You've got significant members of your party who simply can't say the election wasn't stolen.
Well, listen, George, I don't think there's any question that what the whole country needs to focus on in terms of our elections is making sure that we have some effective electoral reform. Nobody wants to wait a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, which happened in some of the House races, to get election results. We need to work on that and make the system better for 2022. But this election was not stolen. All of the facts point in that direction. And I'm a former prosecutor, George. I make decisions based upon evidence, not based upon feelings or partisanship or loyalty. You make those decisions based upon evidence. And the evidence here has shown right from the beginning that while every election has some irregularities, and I'm sure this one did too, there were no type of irregularities that would have changed the result in any one state, let alone the four states that would need to have been changed for the result of the election to have been changed. And folks in my party who are doing that, quite frankly, are just trying to make political points with those people who the president and others lied to about this over the course of the 10 weeks after the election. And it's shameful that they're doing it.
And Margaret Hoover, what does it mean for the Republican Party going forward?
Look, the Republican Party, there's no question, is fractured. And a lot is going to depend on how Mitch McConnell, the leaders in Washington, frankly, a real difference between the Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House of Representatives, navigate the next 2 to 4 weeks. And then what President Trump does out of office. You know, he's rabble-rousing that he's going to start his own third party. I don't think he has a real sense of historic irony there. There is a history of conservative populist third parties in this country that don't have a lot of political success. I'm looking at the Know-Nothings, the American Independence Party, the Dixiecrats. So they can do that. But the Republicans, if they're going to be successful, are going to need to grow the party from the middle, build out with Latinos and Black Americans. And Republicans know how to do this. If you look at Republican governors in blue states, Larry Hogan, Phil Scott, Charlie Baker, they need to take a page from those playbooks. That's how you grow the Republican Party into the future.
Matthew Dowd, let me finish this off with you. Can the Republican Party avoid this reckoning? Is it going to fracture?
No, it can't avoid the reckoning because the problem is that they have a loyalty to a person or a party more so than they do the truth. There are some Republicans like Chris Christie that have spoken the truth in this regards in the aftermath of the November election. But when you put the interest of a person in an autocracy over the interests of our democracy and our Constitution, this is the problem you get into. Right now, though, the fracture is going to be a small part of people, of Republicans who are reasonable and who believe in the truth, and a much larger part of the Republican Party who buys into conspiracy theories and only wants power for power's sake and in the end of it. And so if there is a fracture, it means a small part of the Republican Party who probably ends up aligning with the Democrats in the short term in this that small part. And then the larger 75 or 80% of the party, if you look at every poll, still supports the sort of autocratic moves that President Trump made before Election Day and spoke and made after Election Day. That's the fundamental problem today with the Republican Party.
So Rahm Emanuel, what does this mean for President Biden's agenda going forward? You see resistance to his COVID plans right off the bat, and you know that this impeachment trial is going to complicate his early days.
Well, George, let me reframe the question, because I think actually impeachment for both parties, your question is, does it derail the president's agenda? And so far, he's shown nothing but concentration and capability around COVID and also about moving the country forward. I actually think for the Republicans, rather than for Biden, it's about derail. For them, it is about this division. We just spent three answers about how bad Donald Trump still is for the Republican Party, and he's driving a Grand Canyon-like wedge in the Republican Party. You see what's going on in Arizona. The 10 Republicans in Congress all have primaries. And I would say to you that the impeachment is more of a threat of division within the Republican Party than it is about derailing Joe Biden's agenda. They're going to be able to show that they can move forward, and that's what the executive order showed, and that's what the agenda has showed. And I do think one other thing. We shouldn't confuse unity that the president's calling for with consensus in Congress. Those are not the same thing and collapse them into some one meeting. Unity is actually having a White House that has best practices rather than being a super spreader event. Unity is around how to achieve 100 million doses of vaccination versus having bleach and Lysol recommended as healthcare events, so or healthcare medications. So to me, the country's responding to the president's notion on COVID of concentration, capability, and competence. And there is unity around that. And I think the country is responding to Joe Biden because it's calmed down, it's focused, and it's dealing with the number one threat to the country.
Chris Christie, what's the best way for Republicans in Congress now, in both the House and the Senate, to approach that?
Well, listen, I think they have to be smart about supporting a COVID package that makes sense. Now, you know, what it's starting to look like to me is it's becoming a Christmas tree where everybody gets to hang their favorite ornament on it. I don't know what a $15 minimum wage has to do with COVID relief at the moment. We're talking about immediate relief that we need to get to individuals, to small businesses, and to make sure that our vaccination program is as efficient and effective as possible. That's what Republicans should be talking about. And I think that, again, this is going to be one of those battles we're going to see. And we're much better as a Republican Party when we're talking about issues that are going to matter to the American people. We're going to need to get a COVID package done. We will get a COVID package done. But we shouldn't just give in on every one of those pieces. And that's what we should be focused on, is talking about and challenging why certain things are in that package that, quite frankly, in my view, don't belong there.
So, Margaret Hoover, that's going to present a big challenge to Joe Biden. He's going to, in some ways, have to choose between size and speed. The bigger the package is, the harder it's going to be to get Republican support quickly. The smaller it is, he can get it out quickly and show tangible results for real Americans.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, if anybody can negotiate that, navigate that, look at the 50-50 Senate. And Joe Biden is a pragmatist and he knows how to negotiate. You know, I think we're going to see a COVID package, and it won't be everything that Chuck Schumer and the progressives want, but it'll be a package that'll probably be more targeted, frankly, to the real businesses that need the relief rather than these blanket checks to everyone. Look, I have a lot of confidence in Joe Biden. He does get a little bit of a honeymoon period, and then we're going to be on to impeachment. I just have to say, reconciliation with what happened in the Republican Party is something that I suspect you're going to have Mitch McConnell and the Republicans go along and try to get a COVID deal done. But I suspect that Mitch McConnell would like to see the climate created for a very fair and judicious impeachment project, impeachment process that could lead to conviction of the president. And I think that's why you see him, Chuck Schumer, agreeing to his timeline. I think that's why you see them being very methodical about it, so that they can't hang this out on a procedural vote, that it is fair. And if he is able to create the circumstances and the climate around a fair trial, they may just get 67 votes to convict.
It seems like a hard climb right now, Matthew Dowd. Is it necessary for the Republican Party?
Well, to me, the impeachment vote, we have to separate the parts of the impeachment vote. I mean, other countries have gone through this before: Germany, Japan, South Africa. And the thing before you get to reconciliation and healing, you have to have some element of truth and accountability in this. And even besides those foreign country examples, we have an example in our country. During Reconstruction and the aftermath of the Civil War, when we went through, we were supposed to go through a process of truth and accountability and changing the nature of what went on. And when Abraham Lincoln was killed and Andrew Johnson took over, the idea of forming a thing and demanding truth was stopped. And what did that result in, George? It resulted in this country of Jim Crow laws. It resulted in this country of the KKK, and it resulted in this country of 100 years more of a fight for justice and truth and equality in our country. And so we have to get to a situation where, yes, let's have a discussion about what was the truth, what did Donald Trump do, what is should be his accountability, and the final stage of that is what should be his punishment. And to me, the only way to do that is to have a conversation in a trial in the Senate where facts and knowledge and data and information is presented in such a way that the American public can see exactly what went on, what was Donald Trump responsible for, what should he be held accountable to, and then ultimately, what should his punishment be. But we should not do what happened in Reconstruction, when Reconstruction was ended and we went through this huge, long, century-long process when justice finally prevailed in the end. We have to have an insight into the truth before we get to reconciliation and healing.
Agree with that, Rahm Emanuel?
100%. Let me say this, George. When somebody is running around the Capitol with T-shirts that say Camp Auschwitz, Confederate flags, 6 million wasn't enough, I'm sorry, there is not a statute of limitation when it comes to defending the Constitution. And if you have a wound in the body, body politic, it must be disinfected to be cleaned. And this story is going to get worse as time goes on. And that's what Mitch McConnell knows. It is not going to get better in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Information is not static here. And you're going to find out that the president of the United States was more than just encouraging from the sidelines what happened here. And Republicans in Congress. And if we are going to move forward in some sense as a country, you must come to terms with a president of the United States who encouraged people who were walking around with T-shirts that said Camp Auschwitz, where one of the greatest horrors against humanity was committed. And I'm sorry. You can't have a process point which says, well, he's out of office.
Well, that's what I want
to
bring
Democrats. To the Democrats, I would argue it's not just about the conviction. It's about focusing that he can never run again for office, and that is because of what he's done, and he has to both be morally judged and then politically and legally judged.
And that could be a resolution on the 14th Amendment. Chris Christie, let me bring that question to you. It does seem like more and more Senate Republicans are coalescing around this argument, a process argument, that it's not constitutional to try a former president. Is that enough of an exit ramp?
Well, we're going to see, George, based upon some of what Rob just said, depending upon how the facts. Again, I go back to let's see what the facts are. But what we also need to remember here, too, and this is going to be the challenge for President Biden in terms of bringing the country together. All the things that Rob just said are absolutely right in terms of what happened up on Capitol Hill. It's inexcusable. I said that I thought that it was impeachable and that these things are just wrong. But also, the violence that's happening in other parts of the country are wrong too, George. And the president needs to speak out about both. You can't just continue to talk about what happened on Capitol Hill, which deserves to be spoken about, and all the facts need to come out, and those that are responsible need to be held responsible criminally and politically. But so does the violence that's happening in other parts of the country as well, George. And we cannot allow that to be two different standards. And so one of the challenges for the president is going to be for him to speak very clearly when there are other violent acts that continue to go on in the country and to be able to say that's wrong too. Peaceful protest is one thing. Violence that destroys lives, destroys property, and destroys the peaceful enjoyment of our country is also wrong. Just as wrong as what happened on Capitol Hill on January 6th, because it affects those citizens who live in those places. And I know, Rob, you've had plenty of time to talk this morning. Let me finish. If we want fairness and we want unity in the country, then let's have fairness and unity and have comments on everything that's happening in this country, not just that very awful incident, which I think many Republicans have denounced, including me.
Ron?
So what I would say here, first of all, the president has spoken that there's no place for violence. But what I will reject is the idea that somehow what happened in Portland is morally equivalent to literally a Confederate flag, and 6 million is not enough. One is defending the Constitution and the country and the organizing principles and values of this country, and also prosecuting people who created property crimes. And if you draw a moral equivalence, you're morally lost.
Margaret?
Yeah. One of the things I'm looking forward to in the Biden era is the cessation of the whataboutism that we were so addicted to in the Trump era. Well, if they're doing this, what about this? You know what? Let's not do whatabouts. Let's separate them. There was an insurrection on the Capitol that the president of the United States actually encouraged and pointed his supporters to. We can deal with that in its own vessel, and then separately deal with other acts of violence. They are separate. There is no whataboutism here, and we can do that. We can
Chris?
Do all of it. And what I will say about the impeachment is just give it time to have a fair and timely and open, transparent process, and the American people and the Senate may very well do exactly the right thing, which is truth and justice that can then lead to reconciliation.
Chris?
Yeah, this is not about moral equivalence, and Rom knows better than that. The fact is, for the people in Portland, for the people in other places in this country who have seen their cities and their neighborhoods destroyed and disrupted, their constitutional rights are being violated as well. And so there are constitutional arguments to be made on both sides, and it's not about making the two of them equivalent. What I'm saying is that a president of the United States who says he wants to unite the country has to talk about both of them, and has to talk about them not just this broad sense of violence is bad, but then speak about all the rest of that. And I think that's what I'm talking about. And a real president who wants to unite the country will do that.
Matt?
George?
Let Matt go, and then you.
I'll listen, and I'm not saying this that Chris is doing this, but that it is incredibly frustrating to listen to so many Republicans talk about why isn't Biden talking about this, and why isn't Biden, and we need unity, and we need healing, and we need fiscal level of responsibility. I mean, it is the triple crown American pharaoh level of hypocrisy and dishonesty after what we've witnessed the last 4 years in division, in polarization, in no condemning of white supremacists and white nationalists throughout many Republicans who enabled this. So just give me a break about calling Joe Biden out for any of this right now because of what happened over the last 4 years.
Yeah, I would say, Ron? Look, the impeachment, as Margaret said, and I agree, let it happen. The facts are going to come out. I think the American people are going to make a judgment. It will have its own political imperative. And second, to compliment to what I think President Biden's done, he is focusing, he's concentrated, he's showing capability around COVID. And that is where there is consensus in with a sense of urgency that the country is got to be focused on. And the country's rallying behind Biden because they know if he succeeds in all this, their lives are going to get better. And that's why, in fact, it's more than just a honeymoon. It is a real turn of a page in contrast to a White House that was at one time a super spreader event and a White House that was literally hawking different kinds of crazy theories of medications that could help. And that is the return to normalcy that Biden presents. And he is in perfect ways still Donald Trump. And it's working.
Chris, we have 30 seconds left. Is getting something done best for both sides on COVID?
Yeah,
yes.
It is.
Well, yes. Getting something done is
best for both sides for COVID because George, that's what the American people want. But what the American people also want is to make sure they have a president who truly wants to unify the country and speaks to all of it. And that's not comparing it to before. That's Joe Biden trying to reach the goal he set out in his inaugural speech on Wednesday. And I hope he does it.
And that is all we have time for. That's all for us today. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Check out World News Tonight, and I'll see you tomorrow on GMA.
ABC News, honored winner for the second straight year with the Edward R. Murrow Award for Overall Excellence in Television. ABC News, America's number one news source.